Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Coming up, the presidential inauguration in Zimbabwe due to take place today is halted. We look at the US response. Also ahead...
They're incredibly problematic, they're misogynistic, but I think that they give us an indication of the kind of art that was being made at the time.
And we'll examine art in Weimar, Germany, and try some Levantine food, as well as...
They open doors for you. They don't spoon-feed you. They tell you, here's what happened, here's what people said about it, and if you want to read more, this is where to go.
If you want to know more about World War II in 150 pages, we have the guide for you. Plus, Marie Bion will go through all the weekend's papers. That's to come here on this hour, live from London, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24. The sound of the national anthem of Zimbabwe, which was due to be played today to celebrate the inauguration of Emmerson Mnangagwa, the man who claims he won the presidential vote in the country.
Therefore, Mnangagwa Emmerson Dambudzo of ZANU-PF party is duly declared elected president of the Republic of Zimbabwe with effect from the 3rd of August 2018.
But the ceremony has been put on hold, if not cancelled altogether.
This election as a presidential result is fraudulent, illegal, illegitimate, and characterized by serious credibility gaps.
The opposition MDC Alliance has filed court papers alleging electoral fraud, and until the case has been heard, there will be no political coronation. There was enormous violence after the largely peaceful poll. The army used live bullets on protesters, killing several, and have been going house to house, targeting polling agents, as well as MDC supporters and officials. The crackdown has prompted an international response, with foreign governments and human rights organisations deploring the situation and advocating for calm. One of those lending his voice is Jeffrey Smith. He's a human rights, African affairs and civil society expert and the executive director of Vanguard Africa.
I've been working on Zimbabwe and with human rights activists, civil society activists and certain members of the political opposition for upwards of a decade now. So it's a country I'm very familiar with and have been to a number of times. And what we've been doing recently is really trying to help elevate the issue of Zimbabwe on the international stage, get people talking about the elections, the need for reform, the need for a commitment to democratic processes by the new president, and engaging with media professionals and journalists to really get this conversation on the international stage and get people paying attention to what we feel is a really crucial issue, not only for Zimbabwe, but for the region writ large in so many ways. My belief is that Zimbabwe, you know, really is the fulcrum upon which prosperity and stability rests in southern Africa. So it's a crucially important country for us. And, you know, we remain committed to our partners on the ground there.
Now, in terms of democratic principles, it's clear that those have been breached recently in Zimbabwe, absolutely against what the president-elect Emmerson Mnangagwa has been saying. He's been saying it's a new dispensation, that Zimbabwe is open for business. But there's been an enormous crackdown on opposition activists, officials and supporters by the state, although Mr. Mnangagwa denies that he's behind this in any way. Now, what that did was prompt an appeal, really, by the opposition and by human rights workers to the international community. And what's been astonishing to me is that the former colonial power, Britain, with whom Zimbabwe obviously has a long relationship, was not nearly as forthright in reacting to this as the US. Why do you think that is?
First and foremost, to your first point about President Mnangagwa presenting himself in an impressive and actually very slick way, that he represents something new in Zimbabwe. But anyone who's paid attention to Zimbabwe over the past few years, as I have, knows fundamentally that the new regime in Zimbabwe is hardly new. While Mugabe and his wife Grace have departed the scene, those in control are the very same henchmen who kept Mugabe in power for nearly 40 years. The new vice president, for instance, is the army general who led the de facto coup in 2008. Second, despite the rhetoric that you mentioned, Mnangagwa had no intention of losing the ballot. He had no intention of holding a free and fair election. And we saw that come to fruition to many people. You know, you heard before the election, many top officials already admitting publicly that the military would safeguard their survival in power. And I think third, many people talk about the plundering and the looting and the human rights abuses that took place under Mugabe's rule. He wasn't alone in that. While the regime talks about Zimbabwe being open for business, this is the same group of people that systematically destroyed Zimbabwe's economy over nearly 40 years. Mnangagwa in particular and his allies have enriched themselves for decades, you know, by seizing farms, mines, businesses, losing a reportedly $15 billion in, you know, missing diamond revenue. So the notion that somehow these people are suddenly reformers or overnight Democrats who can engineer a recovery, I think, is a farce of grand proportions.
It's important to point out that Emmerson Mnangagwa is the only individual who's personally named in the UN report on diamond theft from the Congo.
I don't think President Mnangagwa became one of the richest men in Southern Africa by accident. And again, he's not alone. If you look, his administration is a veritable who's who of notorious looters and plunderers. Ober Mpofu, the Home Affairs Minister, is a prime example. And not many people talk about him because, you know, those in other positions, Chiwenga among them, get most of the headlines and receive much of the attention, when in fact the entire regime is chock full of some of the more notorious looters and human rights abusers in Zimbabwe's history.
So now back to America. There's been really a lot of support coming from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and added to that, of course, the renewal of sanctions. If we could just start off with sanctions, and if you could explain to me what that means for ordinary Zimbabweans, because there's a lot of alarm being fostered in Zimbabwe, I believe falsely, around the fact that this hurts ordinary citizens.
One of the bright spots in this entire ordeal with Zimbabwe and U.S. relations has been the robust role of the U.S. Congress. I think in this day and time in the U.S., speaking as an American, we're in a very precarious situation in which we have an administration that at this time and for the past, you know, year and a half hasn't really shown the strong principled commitment to democracy and human rights that previous administrations have, both Democrat and Republican. But the U.S. Congress, on a bipartisan basis, has been quite strong on this issue, particularly in regards to Zimbabwe. And you're right, the sanctions issue is fraught with myths and misconceptions, much of which has been spread by Zimbabwe state media and propaganda online, in print, and elsewhere. So I think it's necessary to sort of parse through that and separate fact from fiction. The fact remains that these are targeted sanctions that apply to only a handful of Zimbabwean individuals and entities, mostly farms and legal entities owned by mostly ZANU-PF officials. And the United States government has been, you know, is very transparent about this. You can actually go to the Treasury Department's website and there's a list of all the individuals there. The other fact is that the United States implemented these targeted sanctions in 2003. And why did they do that? This was a result of the actions and policies of certain members of the government, President Mugabe, now President Mnangagwa, among others, and other persons who are fundamentally undermining democratic institutions and processes in Zimbabwe. So, you know, certain persons in Zimbabwe have been targeted for sanctions on the basis of their connection to the government, but U.S. sanctions, and this is an important point, do not block the government of Zimbabwe as a whole, nor do they prohibit business with the country of Zimbabwe or transactions involving that jurisdiction. So many people somehow have this thought that there's an embargo on Zimbabwe, that there's a trade embargo, that, you know, Zimbabwe is being specifically targeted by the government as a whole, when in fact that's not the case. And not to make this too confusing, but there's also an important point here too, that U.S. targeted sanctions program is not governed by Zadera. They're actually different policies enacted by different branches of the U.S. government. So while the targeted sanctions program began in 2003, when then President Bush signed an executive order, the U.S. Department of Treasury, specifically the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, implements and manages the targeted sanctions policy.
So then what is Zadera?
So Zadera was a law enacted by the U.S. Congress, not by executive order, whereas the sanctions program was. So Zadera was from 2001, which restricts the United States to vote in support of new assistance to Zimbabwe from international financial institutions. So Zadera, to sort of expound upon this a bit further, restricts the United States to vote in support of new assistance from international financial institutions, except for programs that meet basic human needs and promote democracy. But it's also, again, this is where it gets complicated. It's important to understand here that while Zadera does block the U.S. From voting in favor of these new loans to the government, Zimbabwe became ineligible for loans in 1999, well before Zadera, because it stopped repaying its loans already owed to the World Bank and to the International Monetary Fund, among others. But I also think, again, it's important to point out here too, just to really hone in on this fact that, you know, since 1980, I believe, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the U.S. has provided, you know, over $2.5 billion in assistance to Zimbabwe. So the fact that, or the myth that prevails that there's somehow an embargo on Zimbabwe is just simply not true, and really has been this sort of propaganda bomb that has been exploited by those in power. And unfortunately, you know, lots of people believe it.
And there is a way to change this. I mean, if Zimbabwe came in line with democratic principles, then those blocks on international monetary institutions engaging with the country would certainly be eased somewhat.
Exactly. Like, and many of the activists I talk to in Zimbabwe, you know, both in rural and urban areas, they have a pretty consistent refrain. You know, obviously, the issue of U.S. sanctions are, you know, often a very popular topic. But what I hear very frequently is, you know, the only sanctions on Zimbabwe have been brought upon by ZANU-PF through their disastrous, ruinous policies for nearly 40 years. You know, the United States did not steal the elections in 2008. They didn't steal the elections prior to that. They did not undertake a genocide in the 1980s or help engineer that, as now President Mnangagwa did. So all these human rights abuses that have added up, again, over nearly four decades, were engineered, instituted, and advanced by those in power, not by the United States. And that's not to say I'm in any way an ardent supporter of sanctions. I think they can often be counterproductive. But I think it's important during this discussion, or when having these discussions, to really parcel fact from fiction. And I just don't think that's the case with Zimbabwe.
There is going to be the remembrance, celebrations of our heroes.
Now, tomorrow is Heroes Day in Zimbabwe, when fighters from the Liberation War are remembered. And it's followed on Tuesday by Armed Forces Day.
We are receiving information that some think, because of the poll petition, would mean that other national events have also been called off. That is not true.
There's much debate amongst Zimbabweans about whether they should turn up for the twin celebrations. In the past, the ruling party has often forced attendance at such events or offered incentives in the form of free food and drink and transport. This time, the mood is very different, and a movement to stay away is gathering momentum, with many expressing concern that they will be further targeted by the military if they don't show. One person who may not make it is the man who should be at the centre of the events, retired General Constantine Chiwenga. As the former commander of the Zimbabwe Defence Forces and the Zimbabwe National Army, he was in control as Robert Mugabe was ousted by the military in November. He's now vice president, as well as Minister for Defence, Security and War Veterans. But on Friday, he went to Russia. He said Mnangagwa had sent him there with a special message for the Kremlin about the elections. Well, we're all aware of Russia's reputation concerning elections. Jeffrey Smith, should we be worried?
I think there certainly is cause for concern. And I think the growing relationship, or what seems to be a growing, strengthening relationship between Harare and Moscow is cause for concern. But it's also part of a wider global trend. I think you're seeing a growing authoritarian solidarity across the globe. You're seeing the rise of populism in parts of Europe that haven't seen that for generations. You're seeing that sentiment start to rise in the United States as well. The really important point is democracy depends in no small part on political elites' willingness to work with political opponents and to exercise political power with restraint rather than ruthlessness. And when political elite, such as those in Zimbabwe, begin playing no-holds-barred politics, nations really risk slipping towards a hardened authoritarianism. And by the very public embrace of horribly ruthless leaders in Moscow and elsewhere, this is only strengthening the narrative that the current crop of leaders in Zimbabwe really have no intention of safeguarding the basic human rights of their citizens, but rather further entrenching their power and further entrenching their selfish interests. And I think there are dire consequences here. There's a strong correlation. Study after study will show that Africa's entrenched leadership is directly tied to development and security challenges, including conflict or instability, stagnant and declining economies, as well as overall backsliding. And I think that's what we're witnessing in Zimbabwe. And again, it goes to the earlier point that we're talking about today, that this is not a new dispensation. Zimbabwe, you know, Mnangagwa may claim that Zimbabwe is open for business, but as many activists have asked, is Zimbabwe open for freedom? Is it open for free and fair elections? And I think the actions of the government has certainly answer that question, and it's a very resounding no.
And what could Chiwenga be possibly saying in Moscow?
I wish I was privy to those conversations. I think it would certainly be interesting to be a fly on the wall there. But these entrenched regimes don't stay in power by coincidence. You know, it's not a coincidence that Putin and the cabal in Moscow have been in power for decades now. It's not a coincidence that ZANU-PF has been in power for nearly four decades. Unfortunately, in this day and age, these authoritarian actors cooperate and work together much better than democratic advocates work together, than civil society advocates work together across borders. And I think that's something we need to work on ourselves. We're getting beat at the game. And I think that's a lesson that we should take from this, is that we need to really start talking and working together much better than those in power have been doing.
Many thanks to Jeffrey Smith, the Executive Director of Vanguard Africa. You're listening to Sunday Brunch with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Summer is finally here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. This is when we zero in on quality of life and cities, why we love them, what makes them actually work, and how they need to improve. As always, we reveal our ranking of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. Find out if your city makes the cut. And for the first time, we present our manifesto for creating a more relaxed city, a guide to breathing in and lightening up, and a celebration of everything from taking your kit off to making a bit of a racket. In the affairs pages, we meet the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns, while in design, we take a closer look at greenery in the city and how to do it right. Elsewhere, we take a dip in Geneva's top swimming spot, we tuck into some northern Spanish grub, and we sit down for a mass with the locals in a few Bavarian beer gardens. Prost! That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
This is Sunday Brunch. Prostitutes, murderers and suicides. The art on show at Tate Modern's latest exhibition, Art in Weimar, Germany, isn't meant to soothe or comfort. Instead, the five rooms which make up this free year-long exhibition are unsettling, strange, and reflect the turbulent period between 1918 and 1945 in Germany. Katie Wan is one of the curators of the new show, and she took Emma Nelson for a tour.
The Weimar Republic was an unofficial name given to the German state in between the years of 1919 to 1933. So this period was bookended by the two world wars. And following the First World War, Germany was forced, after the Treaty of Versailles, to pay out huge reparations for their part in the war. And I think as a result of it, this massive destabilization of society, of the economy, of politics, led to this really, really turbulent time in culture and the arts. And I think that the repercussions can be felt all the way through through society and through some of the works that we're seeing now.
When you walk into this exhibition, you're struck just by how strange and really unsettling it is. And how much does that tie in with the fact that you're living in a very unsettled time in Germany at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that might be useful to note is in giving this exhibition the title Magic Realism, we're really looking back to this term that was created by the critic Franz Rowe, who was talking about, he saw a tendency in art of this time, this rise in the uncanny, the disturbing, and in calling it magic realism, he was talking about artists who are looking at the surface details of society and trying to kind of explore ideas of magic, mysticism, and fantasy underneath this.
Mitternacht um Viertel vier klingelt an der Wohnungstür und vor mir steht zitternd mein Freund Kraus.
So what do we have in front of us now?
In front of us we have a print showing bareback riders in indigenous North American dress. And something we know about the circus at the time is that often these people weren't from the places they said they were. It was very easy for people to assume personas. So we see people here in these kind of feathered headdresses. They're carrying guns. They've got patterned clothing. But we don't know whether this is all just a ruse, whether he's misleading us.
Everybody has a sort of a disturbed look about them. What was it like trying to put this collection together, knowing that you would have to choose between one slightly uncanny, strange face and another slightly uncanny, strange face?
We had access to a wonderful selection of works from the George Economou collection, which has particularly strong holdings in this area. And it was an interesting exercise in placing these works next to each other and trying to think of what would really hold its own in this exhibition. I mean, aside from some of them being, I think it could be said, confrontational, I think that the portraits don't necessarily subscribe to conventional ideas of beauty. I think they nonetheless capture our attention. They make you stop, they make you wonder about the people who sat for these artists, and they also, each of them, hold wonderful stories. The work that we're just by now, the portrait of Speedy by the artist Rudolf Schlichter, who was one of the founding Dada, Berlin Dada artists. I think Speedy, she's beautifully rendered. There's great attention to the way in which her hair is detailed, her clothing as well. She's wearing this very vibrant red shawl. But she also has her arms wrapped around herself in a kind of defensive gesture, staring out at us as if we're not so much a friendly counterpart, but someone to be reckoned with.
There's nothing friendly about the woman who's staring you back at you from this canvas. She has this incredibly fierce but rather frightened look in her eyes. She's a typical everyday Hausfrau in terms of she wears very smart, very well put together German outfits. But behind her, quite oddly, there's this really strange landscape and a moonscape behind her.
Yeah, I mean, something that we really noticed across a number of different portrait works during the time of magic realism is this reference to a cosmic landscape. It's kind of almost not something too different from what you'd see in kind of fantasy graphic novels of more recent years. But actually, I would just counter what you say about her being this kind of Hausfrau, because in the time of Weimar Germany, there was also this concept of the new woman and the Neue Frau. And I think that Speedy really does epitomize this. Even though she's the wife of the artist, she appears to have agency, to have personality. I think the cosmic landscape indicates an inner psychological world that Schlichter is trying to express here.
This is an unusual room full of, the only way I could describe it is freakishly complicated characters. Tell us what we're looking at and what kind of image or idea is being promoted in this room. We have a man over there who seems to have committed suicide. This is a very important part of your collection, this one, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. This is a painting by the artist George Gross, and it's called Suicide. I'd say it's about half a meter in width. It's predominantly covered in areas of red. it's very chaotic. I mean, all sense of perspective and scale are completely collapsed. We have a man who's lying at the front with perhaps a gun that's just fallen out of his hand, whereas on the left top-hand side of the canvas, we have a figure who's hung himself. And then right at the top right-hand side, there's a burlesque dancer or kind of sex worker figure, a semi-nude woman. And I think that what Dix is expressing here is the destabilization of life. We know that in a time of high unemployment, social disarray, that suicide was particularly high at this time. And not only that, but it was really sensationalized in the tabloid press. And so we have some indication of the way in which people both were horrified by suicide, but also took some morbid pleasure in reading and seeing depictions of it.
There's an almost sexy drama to it, isn't there? It's very odd to see.
The woman who's looking out, I mean, she's got this kind of heavily rouged face. I think she definitely gives it a different connotation than if she weren't in the scene at all.
This isn't an exhibition if you want flowers and fairies, is it? This is an exhibition if you want to examine the slightly darker side of the world and of the human mind. And these two pictures in front of us exemplify that perfectly, don't they? They're angry and they're violent.
Yeah, I think they're incredibly problematic. They're misogynistic, but I think that they give us an indication of the kind of art that was being made at the time. I mean, the time of the Weimar Republic gave particular rise to this genre of art called Lustmord. It also appeared in literature. For example, we think of Alfred Döblin's work, his master work of literature, Berlin Alexanderplatz, which gives many references to sex workers and to the parts of society that they frequented, murder, rape.
Why do you think that we don't see more exhibitions of this period brought together more often?
I think we were incredibly lucky at this time to have this opportunity to put on a selection of works from this era. I mean, within Tate's collection, I mean, we just don't particularly have strong holdings in this area. So this exhibition becomes a way for us to return some of the works we do have in our collection by, say, George Grosz, Otto Dix, Herbert Gershner, to the context in which they originally belonged to.
And having put this together over the last couple of years, how do you want someone who comes to this exhibition to feel as they leave?
I think it's really important for people to come to the museum and feel connected to their emotions as well as to learn about different periods that happened. I hope that people feel entertained. I hope they feel shocked by some of the content because it is pretty disturbing. I hope that it encourages them to go away and find out more about the artists who lived in this time and the era. I mean, this isn't intended to be an exhaustive representation of Weimar Germany, but I hope it kind of nudges people to go and find out more.
Katie Wan and Emma Nelson there. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Now it's time for a regular Sunday Brunch feature called Weekend Reads. Each week I speak to a different author about their latest work, and this week it's John Connell, founder of The Week. John is now editor of All You Need to Know, a series of guidebooks on various subjects that help explain the world around us. The first three titles of the series are on slavery, the British Empire, and the Second World War. Well, I began by asking him about how the series came to be.
Quarto, a publisher in London, approached me and they said they would like to do something broader because they thought, as I think, that there's a gap in the market in the sense that a lot of us are what are called autodidacts. We want to know more about stuff, but we don't want to necessarily read 700 pages on all these topics. So, for example, one of my early All You Need to Know books, which is Max Hastings' World War II, is actually a shortened version of All Hell Let Loose, which is 700 pages long. My version of it is 128. And I think, You know, there are a lot of people who want to know about World War II and prepared to spend 2 hours reading about it, but they might not be prepared to read 700 pages.
I think you've got the format absolutely right. They're all roughly around 120 pages. They're simple, they're digestible. And then, of course, there is a list of further reading. If it all piques your interest and you want to know more, you know exactly where to go for that information.
Exactly. So they open doors for you. They don't spoon feed you. They tell you, here's what happened, here's what people said about it, and if you want to read more, this is where to go. And what you get with Max Hastings, you get vivid anecdotes and you get his very bold judgments about how people behaved during the war.
And of course, speaking of Max, what you have is hugely authoritative voices. You've got the very best writers on these topics.
Well, I've tried to. Yes, I think that's important too, because when I started the week, I felt, well, you can't just have a bland digest which says the Times says this and the Telegraph says this. It has to have character. It has to have an attitude, because if it has a character, people will follow you and they'll want to keep buying it. And in the same with these books, they need an authoritative figure to lead you through. It's rather like a barrister in court producing witnesses on the one side or the other, but you follow the barrister's argument.
Well, let's look at the three titles. As you say, World War II, an account of the war from the invasion of Poland to the surrender of Japan. So it's covering 1939 to 1945.
It covers the whole way through, exactly. And that's quite some feat. And I've obviously had to take a few liberties. So some of the great naval battles in the Pacific, for example, one has had to condense. And you probably don't know what the second country invaded in World War II was. Very few people do. But I will tell you, it was Finland, and it wasn't invaded by the Germans. It was invaded by the Russians. But they got bogged down quite quickly. So that is referred to, but I don't really have the space to do much on it. I've concentrated, as one probably should, on the main events of the war and the key battles.
Moving on to the next one. Now, this one is about the British Empire. It's by Piers Brandon. And it starts with the wonderful line, "The sun never set upon the British Empire because God didn't trust the British in the dark."
It's a good line, isn't it? Exactly. It's always been a contentious subject, and people will come to different conclusions reading Piers's book. He himself, in the end, comes down against the empire, but he comes down more because he's against empires in general. He thinks that as empires went, the British did a good job, but he doesn't, you know, as many don't, approve of the whole imperial notion. But it's a fascinating story, the way this tiny island built up such a vast empire and then how quickly it lost it.
I mean, these are absolutely huge topics, aren't they? The third in the series is slavery, which couldn't be more enormous.
Well, I know. And the other thing about slavery, it is so much, when you mention the word slavery, everyone immediately thinks of the transatlantic slave trade, which, of course, was important. But, you know, what we forget is that actually, until relatively recently, in most parts of the world, slavery was probably more the rule than the exception, and freedom was the exception. And although the transatlantic slave trade is very important, long before that, in ancient Greece, in China, everywhere, really, slavery was predominant.
And as this book points out, it hasn't ended yet.
It hasn't ended yet, exactly. I mean, it's still going on. What's changed is that whereas once upon a time all the world's major religions were essentially, if not pro-slavery, they at least didn't object to it. Now they do. And all responsible governments in the world are now very anti it, whereas before they weren't. So, you know, there is a fundamental change. It is now, as it were, below the radar. It is now something which most people regard as a total abomination, whereas before they didn't regard it as such.
Those are the first three coming out this month. What are your further plans?
Well, Robin Hanbury Tennyson is doing The Greatest Explorers. We've also got Janie Lewis, who's the City Editor of the Week, doing The European Union. Topic of great interest, particularly given Brexit. So how did it all come about? Who thought it up? Yeah, who are the personalities behind it all? We're trying to do it in a way which isn't too dry, but have plenty of anecdotes. And then we're doing something very different, which is how to read a poem. And that is by Malcolm Hebron. And it's the whole idea is to try and explain how poetry works and how poets create the effects that they do. But then after that, we're going to broaden out still further. We're going to do other historical subjects, but we're going to do the history of sexuality, for example. We're going to do how to write well. Tim DeLisle, the former arts editor of the Times, is doing that. So there's a whole variety of things that we're going to try and do.
Well, and I think they all sound absolutely amazing. I cannot wait to read the series and fool people that I actually know a lot more about everything than I do, because that's the great beauty of these guys. You are instantly informed.
Well, that's the idea. It should be fairly instant. It should be fairly immediate. And it should be done in a lively, entertaining way, so you don't feel you're just getting some bit of dusty academia.
That's Jolyon Connell. His All You Need to Know guides are out now. To hear more from authors, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. Up next, we go through the weekend papers.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless. Thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
Hello, this is Sunday Brunch on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and it's time now to look through the weekend papers. So I'm joined in the studio by Marie Bion, who is a journalist for French media. Thanks for coming in on this Sunday morning.
Hi.
Rainy Sunday morning. Heatwave is over, it would appear.
Well, yeah, for now. Apparently it's going to be warm again at the end of August, which is good, because we're already missing the sun, basically.
Can't keep us happy. Let's start with the Financial Times. Now, this is a story we've been reporting in our news bulletin. It's all about the currency in Turkey, which, of course, Erdogan is saying, what crisis?
Yes, well, he's saying that basically, so the lira has plunged 14%, which is, of course, not good. And it's, of course, mainly because of the tariff that Donald Trump has imposed in terms of steel and aluminium. And the US is the main market for Turkish steel, which is, so basically, it's a big problem for Turkey. But Turkey is saying, basically, it's an economic war. And what we have to do is find new friends. And it's OK that we don't have the backing of the US, because we're just going to find new friends. And the FT doesn't say that, basically, but in it says that the Russian ruble also went down, basically, because of all the context and all that. And Erdogan basically cited Russia as a possible new friend of Turkey. So having the same woos, basically, they already have something in common. And of course, it's not too good for the US if Turkey and Russia get on a bit better. So it might be some kind of a show by Erdogan saying that look at what we're going to do if you go on this trajectory. But apparently it doesn't work, because at the end of the story, the FT reminds that Trump has already said that he's going to put the tariff up. Aluminium will now be 20% and steel 50%. Our relations with Turkey are not good at this time. That's an understatement by Donald Trump. And so basically, yes, a big a bit of a worry. And another solution that Erdogan is saying is that if you are sleeping on gold or on euros, please do and dollars, please go ahead and change them now. That's to show the US that we won't be basically abated by their tariff. That won't do a lot to prevent, of course, the economic crisis. So Turkey already had a few economic crises in the last few years. It's the biggest since Erdogan has been in power. And the big difference between now and the other economic crisis is that then they used to have Washington backing. They were helped by Washington. But now Washington is the cause of their problem. So that might be another, that might basically make things even worse. And Erdogan already said, the FT, the ST mentioned, Erdogan already said that he doesn't want any IMF backing, basically. He wants to do it on his own. Problem is, and the FT insists on that twice in the piece, is that investors are not exactly happy about what's happening. First, of course, about the tariff, but also because the government already put forward some kind of plan to try and put things back in order. And the investors are not convinced by what the government is suggesting, meaning that it's not only the direct effect of the steel tariff that's going to be a problem. It's also if investors are really leaving Turkey or invest less, that would basically further the woes of the Turkey. And at the moment, the only solution Erdogan has is to appeal to the national sentiment.
Mm. The FT goes very big on this story. It's carried on inside and another couple of pieces on it. Really great picture, actually, of the finance minister, who is Berat Albayrak, who is in fact Erdogan's son-in-law, which I think is quite interesting. And it's clearly a man under immense pressure. He's mopping his brow in this picture. It's very telling. Right, let's move on to our next paper and let's have a look at should we go to Le Monde? Now this is about Charlottesville. So a year ago, of course, there was big trouble in Charlottesville. Perhaps take us back and remind us what happened.
So there was a rally by protesters who wanted to take down the General Lee statue that was in a park in Charlottesville, which is in the south of the US. And it was a Confederate general, and they wanted basically to take down the statue because it was a symbol of slavery and the negative part of history of the US. So they wanted to take it down, and they demonstrated for that. But there were a counter demonstration by far-right and alt-right demonstrators on that day. And at some point, violence erupted and a guy in his car mauled protesters, and one young lady on 32 died of it, and many were injured. It was an enormous thing, of course, because it was left or far left or protesters, human rights protesters against alt-right. And President Donald Trump didn't manage to condemn the violence by the alt-right, although one person had died. So it was basically a social issue crisis with the idea of the statues. Should they be taken down? Should history be wiped out in a way? The symbol of the past history of the U.S. should they be wiped out? And at the same time, it became a political story with Donald Trump being unable to condemn the violence of the far right and racist. So basically, the idea of this Le Monde story is not talking about basically 1 year after where is Charlottesville in terms of the getting into terms about what happened. It's more looking at the city about what it represents, because we think of Charlottesville now, perhaps in Europe, when we don't know a lot about the city, as basically a very divided city and very representative in terms of the south of the US. But what Le Monde is saying is that it's not the case. For example, the city voted 80% for Hillary and only 13% for Donald Trump. And the main story, in a way, is to show how Charlottesville is one of those towns who, although they have these big statues of a Confederate general in their park, doesn't go big in terms of their history when it goes to the Civil War and the slavery history. Basically, it says that there's only just one plaque in the middle of the town saying that there used to be a slave market here, but they don't say that the KKK used to meet here as well. They don't say a lot of things that happened. There was a lynching outside, just outside the city, and it's not talked about. And what the new mayor, because the new mayor was elected and sworn into office in January, wants to do is to try to reanimate basically the memory of the of slavery and the mistreatment, of course, of black people in Charlottesville. That's been basically wiped under the carpet until a few months ago, until last year. But of course, that means that a lot of people who used to have, you know, a very non-political city are not really happy about these new turns of event. And in council meetings and this kind of thing, there's a lot of the Afro-American community has become very politicized and very present in the council's meeting, and the perhaps the white population a bit less so. So what the Le Monde is showing is a council meeting as well. They're talking about a council meeting where white people are saying we are now basically the minority, we're now disenfranchised because the Afro-American community of our town has decided to be more politicized and go big since then. So the, what Le Monde is showing basically is a way of seeing basically the consequences of Charlottesville, meaning that the town is divided. That's something that we knew, but is divided in a way we didn't think it was, meaning that the Afro-American community wants to go a bit bigger about their story, and the white community feel they are a bit silenced because they still want to have this statue, not as a symbol of the black people being humiliated and into slavery, but a symbol of the history of America that shouldn't be wiped under the carpet. But it's not something that's going through with the very politicized and highly sentimentally charged atmosphere in the town 1 year after.
And also what's being reported today is that yesterday, to mark the anniversary, hundreds of students and left-wing activists took to the streets, and it seems a very racially mixed crowd, just looking at pictures. It was a rally, obviously, marking that event last year. Chants like cops and Klan go hand in hand, obviously making that relationship to the Ku Klux Klan very clear. And there were riot police in riot gear and the protesters asking them why there is no riot here. What are you doing? So very interesting that still people taking the streets to that. Let's now go to the Observer. We are talking about European far-right groups. What's this?
So basically, the story is about Generation Identity, which is basically a far-right group made mainly of young people and young educated white men, let's say. And it's quite big in France. It's big enough in the UK. And there was a gathering of the group of the European branches in the south of France recently. And what the Observer is saying is that during this gathering, they put forward some information to the heads of the group, saying that some in the leadership of their group are linked with neo-Nazis groups. And the head of the UK branch, who is called Tom Dupré, who's 23 and is presented as a former banker. He's only 23, he's already had a career in banking, apparently. He decided to resign because he's saying that it's a big thing that some in the party or in the group are linked to neo-Nazi groups, because that just giving a bad name to their very legitimate, he says, group. Because their main idea basically is that the white population of Europe is being wiped out by mass immigration, and mass immigration meaning for them migration, but also illegal migration and the refugee crisis. And what they did, what they are very famous for, in a way, infamous for, I would say, is their Defend Europe mission, where they basically tried to block the refugee rescue ships to go into land last summer, meaning that those people who were basically in need of help, they didn't want them to basically go be brought in Europe, because otherwise when they get in Europe, they have to be helped, and most of them will have to stay. And it said that it just basically concur into the wiping out of the white race in Europe. So what they're saying is that what they want is a reconquista of Europe, meaning that the white Christian Europe must stay, but the non-Christian, non-white Europe, Europeans should basically be not welcome or perhaps go away. It doesn't say in a way. But what's really important for them is that it's just race-based and not religious-based. That's what they're saying. So a link with neo-Nazi is something that they really want to get rid of. And this resigning of the head of the UK, according to experts, might see the unraveling of this generation identity group, because if they can't basically uphold their young, vibrant, educated visage, basically, they don't have anything to do in the political scene. There are so many far-right groups at the moment. They are the only one who have this stance. And if they can't hold it and be basically as white as possible, meaning that they are as clean as possible, basically, they don't have a leg to stand on.
Yeah. Marie, we've got about 30 seconds to talk about Boris Johnson, so I'm quite glad that the time is short. Yes. Tell us why he's still in the papers.
He's everywhere, basically. It's all on the front page of all the papers, and it's still because, of course, his story that he did, the column that he wrote last week. So the Sun Telegraph has a story now, a column by Boris' dad saying that he was right, his son was right, and the Guardian has another story saying that it's the end of the moral conservatives.
And is it?
And that's what they are arguing. I'm not going to put my foot in that. But it's very conflicting stories one week after. And not just because, I mean, yesterday we heard Jacob Rees-Mogg saying that it was a party issue now. But today it's not a party issue. It's a moral issue. It's something bigger and social.
Marie, thank you very much indeed. And finally, Barry Hilton is the CEO and founder of Seru, a Levantine restaurant. It's inspired by his travels around the countries that form the Levant: Syria, Egypt, Jordan, southern Turkey, Cyprus, Lebanon and Israel. And the menu uses over 100 ingredients. He joined Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and began by talking about the restaurant's name.
Whenever you launch a restaurant, you're always trying to think of a name. And after endless nights in the pub, we still couldn't think of one. So a friend of ours came up with the name Seru, and we said, what does Seru mean? And she said, well, it's short for cerulean blue, which is the azure Mediterranean colour of the water. So I said, that sounds really good, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything offensive in a foreign language, which was also important. So we kicked it around for a bit, and we've ended up adopting it. And most people say it correctly straight away. A few people say Cheru or Keru, but most people say Seru.
And the cuisine of the restaurant is Levantine, which is kind of Eastern Mediterranean. When did you kind of fell in love with this type of food?
Well, I travelled the region quite a lot when I was working. I was in the music business before I was in restaurants. And the last project I did before I started Sarah, I was working with a Lebanese street food company. I had a chef patron who was, you know, a talented Lebanese chef. So I learned about the Lebanese cookbook, effectively. And I was keen to learn more, and then I started to sort of really explore the region in terms of the Ottomans really defined a lot of the cooking in that region. So I then started to look at Syrian cooking, Israeli cooking, which is a bit more of a fusion of everything, and Turkish cooking. And because I'm from Liverpool and I'm Caucasian, so it didn't really seem appropriate to try and do anything too traditional. We decided to come up with our own version of what the flavours represented to us.
Oh, and one of the characteristics of this cuisine, I mean, there's so many kind of different spices and ingredients. I think it's mentioned you use about 100 ingredients and 20 spices in your restaurants alone.
We do. People laugh when they come to our kitchens and see all the spices and think, what are you going to do with all those? We seem to use them in every dish. I don't know how we manage it.
You just launched, I believe, 9 weeks ago or something like that, one in Soho, which is a hotspot for restaurants as well. How would you compare both restaurants, the one in South Kent and Soho?
The one in South Kensington, which was nearly 2 years old now, is more like a sort of neighbourhood restaurant. So you tend to see the same faces again and again, except for this time of the year where a lot of tourists come. Soho is different. It's a larger restaurant, and it's the next evolution of our design. It's got a dedicated bar, so you can actually stand at the bar and have a drink while you're waiting for your meal, which you can't at South Kensington. And obviously, Soho's larger groups, a younger crowd, so it's kind of, the space has been designed really for that sort of use rather than the intimate environment at South Kensington.
I want to find out more about the menu, but first of all, what about drink? Do you have any special drinks? For example, you just gave me here, there's two pale ales as well that you do at the restaurant. I mean, they look wonderful, and I'll be sure to be tasting in a bit.
Absolutely.
But tell us a bit more about which type of drink.
So we have quite a varied drink offer, but most importantly, we have all of our wines are generally from the Levant region. And Levant is a term that's not widely used, although it's becoming more widely used, and it really represents Cyprus, southern Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and sometimes Egypt. So we predominantly serve wine from Lebanon and Turkey. We haven't got any Israeli wines at the moment. We have got some Cypriot wines. And we've recently discovered some wines from Macedonia, which isn't part of the Levant at all, but they're just great wines, so we thought we'd put them on. But we don't serve Pinot Grigio or anything like that. It's a completely eclectic list of wines from the region. Beers, as you say, we've got our own pils and our own pale ale, which Stephen's son makes for us in his microbrewery in Swindon. We make our own homemade lemonades, which we basically make a syrup. So today we've got watermelon lemonade on one machine and apple, mint and ginger on the other. So we make an infused syrup for each of those and then put fresh fruit and lemon juice into. They're pretty popular as well because it's different from a can of Coke or the usual stuff.
In terms of the menu, you have some sort of an all-day menu as well, right? Or how do you divide the menus?
Yeah, I mean, it's all-day dining, effectively. Mm. I mean, we serve brunch at weekends where we do a sort of shakshuka and those sort of things. But yeah, it's an all-day menu with sort of six different food categories. So there's sort of dips and salads, effectively the cold section. We have seafood, vegetarian, meat, and then some sides.
Well, this show is actually called The Sunday Brunch, so I was going to ask, what's your recommendation for a lovely brunch? At zero, perhaps.
Who knows? Brunch, we do a very nice shakshuka sauce. Shakshuka effectively is invented by the Ottomans, although I believe that Morocco also claims it. It's basically a tomato, red pepper, chili and onions sauce that then we put eggs into, or merguez sausage, or halloumi, or whatever we do. People come in at 11 o'clock in the morning, which is when we open, and they might order a shakshuka to share, and then maybe have some dips and then some meat. And
Barry, how challenging it is? I know sometimes the restaurant business can be quite tough here in London, but how challenging is it to have two restaurants instead of one that you were used to?
Going from one restaurant to two restaurants is probably the hardest thing that most people ever do in the restaurant business, because you can't be in two places at once. So, at some stage you have to sort of devolve power to somebody else, a restaurant manager or chef or whoever. That's quite a hard thing to do. I've done it quite a few times before, so I'm used to experiencing the pain. But it does get better. The more restaurants you open, the bigger the team you have, so it's easier to feel more relaxed at night.
And finally, of course, I'm very curious about desserts as well, because I'm the kind of person I always have to have some pudding, So what do you have in offer, Mark?
Well, our desserts are mainly, at this time of the year, they're mainly ice cream based. So, I mean, one of the desserts we do, we recreate the flavours of baklava using a cardamom ice cream and a nut brittle that we make ourselves. We do a sort of panna cotta type thing, which is rose water and honey and ginger. This time of the year, it's mainly ice cream based.
Fernando and his pudding. That was Barry Hilton with our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. It was produced and studio managed by George McDonough. Our researcher was Mariana Legrusta. Now, coming up on the station, we have Lucy Silvers on the Midori House Sessions. And then from midday, Fernando will be back alongside Augustin Macellari. They'll be presenting you the Monocle Weekly. And I'll be here for the rest of the day with lots of music, sharp programming and other things. Do stay tuned. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.